I'm Tenery Taylor. If you were a foodie in the 90s, or even a wannabe foodie, you probably had a copy of Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone in your kitchen. All my friends did. Deborah Madison's cookbook became a Bible of sorts for vegetarians and aspiring vegetarians and people who just knew they should eat more vegetables but needed some guidance and encouragement. Madison has written many more cookbooks since then, but she hasn't lost her focus on vegetables. Just last month, she released a memoir about her culinary and life journey. It's called An Onion in My Pocket, My Life with Vegetables. Deborah Madison, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you so very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you have written that you grew up, and this is a quote, yanked between plenty and scarcity.
That's true.
I want to start with your dad, and then we'll go to your mom, but will you explain your dad's relationship with food?
Well, my dad was from Iowa, and I think he always loved that food, hearty food. But at the end of his life, he did become a vegetarian. But between the beginning and the end, when we knew him, he was very, very generous with food in some ways, and a good baker and a roller of pies and pie dough and all that sort of thing. Whereas my mother was a bit on the stingy side and very concerned about the cost of everything.
Mm. And so scarcity, how did that play a role in your childhood?
Well, I mean, there was never enough, And we find out now, later, my sister points out that you had to kind of eat fast, at the dinner table to get the food that there was. There wasn't a lot. My father started his career fairly late, actually, in life. So he was just an associate professor for a long time when other people were making a lot more money. Scarcity really did affect me. And when I met Alice Waters at Chez Panisse, she was the perfect person for me to know then because she was so generous and she had ample resources. But she was just an incredibly generous person, and I really appreciated that.
But before we get to Chez Panisse, you had an experience as a teenager when you discovered, food could taste good. Every meal could taste good.
Yeah, I did.
Will you tell us about that?
Sure. My parents went to Europe on a sabbatical, and they farmed each of their four kids out to another family. And I really got the long straw for that one because I went to live with a couple who, first of all, they didn't have children. So, I think that really helped. They had taken many sabbaticals to France, and they knew French cooking, French country cooking, and that's what they made all the time, every single night. And the husband in this pair was a botanist like my father was, but his specialty was alliums, and so we always had wonderful leeks and onions and things like that from the garden. We had just wonderful food, and it was so astounding to me. I didn't know food could be so good, and every night of the week. It's a little unfair to my parents now to bring that up in a way because they did the best that they could with what they had, but these people just had more, that's all, and I was privy to taste it and to cook with it and eat it and and it was wonderful.
Do you remember a particular meal from that time that you stayed with them that really just sits in your memory?
Actually, I remember making a cheese souffle and bicycling. They lived out in the country, and so I had to bicycle like 3 miles from school to their house with a girlfriend because I wanted to make a souffle for her because I thought it was just the most amazing thing in the world. And I did get caught escaping school to do that, and that was too bad because I really liked this person, and after that episode, she was forbidden to see me, and she went on to become a doctor, and I didn't, so there you go, for better or for worse.
So how did you get from that experience to the title of your book, An Onion in My Pocket?
Well, the onion in my pocket actually was real. And I had been cooking a little pizza with a friend, and these onions, which I had brought, were leftover, so I took one of them home and put it in my pocket. Actually, I didn't go home. I went to Spanish class, and this was just a year ago or so, and I had this onion, and I took it out to find my pens and my pencils and paper and all that sort of thing that you need for school, and people started to laugh, and I realized, to me, it was utterly normal to have an onion in my pocket or to fly home from a visit to a farmer's market with strawberries on my lap or to reach into the overhead with long stalks of rhubarb that I found in Washington State on a trip there. I mean, this is what we did, and we exchanged food, and it's what food – I realized then I was a food person, and that's what food people did. They were very excited about food. And if you had an onion in your pocket, actually, a friend just told me recently that she reached in her pocket thinking it was a pen and pulled out a stalk of asparagus. So there you go. And she's a food person, too.
Oh, you've got a chapter in your book that's titled 20 Missing Years. And you're talking about a time from the 60s, I think, to the 80s. What was happening in your life then?
Well, I was a Zen student, so I was, you know, busy as a very young person cooking for the first time. And then as an older person, I was the chef of greens. But I felt kind of odd about it. And when I started to write this book, which was 15 years ago, believe it or not, I was very remorse. You know, I felt very badly that I hadn't gone for a PhD. In something, anything, to be more useful in the world. And at that time, I know this is digressing from your question, but at that time, I got a fellowship to a writer's colony for a month. So I wrote about that and my life and so forth. And a year later, when I read it over, I hated it. I thought, it's so moany, groany. Oh, poor me. I didn't get a PhD. Surely there must be something in my life that it matters, you know, that really, really matters. And so I set out to find it. And I wrote three books in the meantime, but that's par for the course.
Well, I have read that you blame a radio show for getting you into Zen Buddhism in the first place.
I do. it was KPFA, which was listener-supported radio from Berkeley. And I used to listen to KPFA because it was the only station on in our house. And Alan Watts spoke about Zen Buddhism twice a week. And my father always listened, so I listened too because it was on. And he was describing once a line of monks and their begging bowls, which is how people got their food at the time of the Buddha. And I felt like I could just see all of this happening so clearly in front of me. And, of course, it was just my imagination, but at that time I thought, I have to do this at some point. I have to address the big questions in life, which Zen is very good at doing, but not yet, not yet. I was still in high school. I was young. I was interested in boys and clothes and going steady and all those kinds of things. So I put it off for a while. But those things don't really go away.
Mm. I want to back up before you actually entered a monastery. You went to Japan on a trip. Mm-hmm. And will you tell us a little bit? I want to know about how, because then you could kind of see it up close. But I'd just like to hear about your experience in Japan. And you happened to be there when the moon landing occurred.
Oh, that's right. I was. I went to Japan, and it was partly a spiritual quest. And I knew that, but I didn't exactly know what I was going to do. And I went with my brother, and we went on a merchant marine ship, and it was absolutely a wonderful trip. It took 2 weeks to get to Yokohama, and it was so amazing. And I was there during the moon landing, and I'd sort of forgotten about it. So when they showed this big screen with the moon and the flag and all of that happening. I thought it was a science fiction movie at first, but then I remembered, oh, the moon landing. And people kept saying, congratulations, congratulations, as if I were responsible for it. And then, but I was there with a young woman, Japanese woman, in a big store. So we went down to the basement, and we celebrated by having these wonderful fish that were, I mean, fake fish. They were dough fish in the shape of a fish, stuffed with red beans, azuki beans. And they were so delicious. And I just remember that. That's all.
And how old were you when you decided to enter the monastery then?
I must have been 22 or something like that. Young enough.
So you're living in a monastery, and you've already referred to Alice Waters. You end up getting a job at Chez Panisse while you're living in the monastery. Will you kind of explain how that happened?
Sure. I was asked to show Alice and Lindsay around our farm, Green Gulch Farm in Marin County, which I did with pleasure, but I didn't know who they were. I'd never heard of the restaurant. I didn't know Lindsay Shear, who is the pastry chef, or Alice Waters, who owned the restaurant. So I just showed them around, and they were very interested, especially Alice was interested in the lettuce and then a cow load, and she asked about cream, and then we passed some dug potatoes, and she asked about potatoes. Lindsay was much quieter. But I finally asked them, had they heard of Richard Olney or Elizabeth David, who were two of my heroes then, and did Lindsay make tartatin? And the answer to all my questions were yes. And Alice said, have you never been to the restaurant? And I wasn't even sure that I had heard of the restaurant, let alone been. And she said, you must come, as if that would explain something. And so three of us went the next night, and it was the food I had dreamed of for so long, the French food I always really wanted to eat. And I loved being there. I loved the food. I loved the care. And when we got back to San Francisco that night, I noticed the Abbot's light was still on. And those students never did this kind of thing. I just went up there and said, I have to work at Chez Panisse. And he said, fine. And I started the next day because Alice had asked me if I wanted to work there. And I loved it.
And then you eventually end up in charge of Greens, as you've referred to, which is the vegetarian Zen Center restaurant. Tell us how that came about.
That came about a short time after Chez Panisse, actually, about a year later. I had gone to France because I decided I needed to see and taste food in its place for myself. And when I came back, I learned about the plans for there to be a restaurant, and I would be the chef. And I was scared witless. I couldn't do anything. I mean, I was so nervous about it. Chez Panisse was my only restaurant experience, and it wasn't really, you know, like other restaurants, to say the least. So, yes, I was very nervous about it. But we did open in 1979, and I was the chef, and it was very, very challenging, to say the least.
And you grew, it was kind of a farm-to-table experience. You grew your food there at the monastery, I think?
The Zen Center did have a farm called Green Gulch Farm, which was in Marin County. It was about 25 miles away. But farm-to-table, seasonal, local, any of those words, we didn't even know about those words then. We didn't even use them. They're not even anywhere in the Greens cookbook, although that's exactly what we were doing. So I thought of it more as farm-driven because our farm was just really getting started at the same time, and it had its challenges, too.
Yeah, I'd like you to tell me about some of your challenges with your vegetables there.
Oh, well, the carrots were always stunted because the ground was very compacted. It was very clay and clayey, and they couldn't really go down, so they just, you know, be short little carrots. But they weren't supposed to be. They were supposed to be longer carrots. The corn that we had planted, the raccoons got it the night before. Mm. We planned to harvest it. So we learned from that very quickly. Broccoli grew very well, but it was infested with aphids, which is really creepy, and you can't serve it to people for fear that, you know, they'll You don't want them to be uncomfortable, but you don't want to use pesticides either. So it took a while to work all that kind of stuff out. Plus, it was very foggy and cold. And so in the summertime, we couldn't grow zucchinis and peppers and tomatoes and, you know, all the wonderful eggplants, for example, all those wonderful hot weather vegetables that you like to cook with in the summertime. So for those, my sous chef and I drove into the valley, Central Valley, every Saturday morning, and we picked them ourselves at a U-Pick.
Mm-hmm. And you write that one lesson you had to work on was not apologizing.
Oh, yeah.
And I want you to tell us about the mushroom soup.
Okay. Yes, not apologizing. Well, because it's about other people. I mean, there are some things you should apologize for, mistaken orders or whatever. But one night we did have a man come in and say, or he sent word with the waiter, how did you get that smoky flavor in your mushroom soup? It's so good, you know. And I thought, oh, no, what smoky flavor? There's not supposed to be a smoky flavor in this soup. And so I lied and I said we had grilled the mushrooms first because I kind of felt like, if he enjoyed the soup and he thought there was a smoky flavor, then we shouldn't take that away from him. Mm-hmm. So we just said, great, I'm so glad you enjoyed it. And then we tasted the soup and we found, in fact, it had scorched. And we threw it out and we substituted another soup for the rest of the evening. But, I mean, what can you do? What can you do in that situation? But you don't want to take away the pleasure somebody had in a soup. And also, the difference between smoked and burned and caramelized is very varied. And it can change so quickly. And if you know baba ganoush is going to be made with a smoked eggplant, then it doesn't taste burned. But if you don't know that, it might taste burned. So we had to just be gracious and say, glad you enjoyed it, basically.
It's time for a quick break here on Constant Wonder. We've been speaking with Deborah Madison, who is the award-winning author of 14 cookbooks, including The New Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone and Vegetable Literacy. In 2016, she was inducted into the James Beard Foundation Cookbook Hall of Fame. Her new memoir is An Onion in My Pocket, My Life with Vegetables. When we come back, we'll find out what she thinks of the label vegetarian. Stay tuned for more Constant Wonder. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. We're speaking with Deborah Madison, who is the award-winning author of 14 cookbooks, including The New Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. Her latest memoir is An Onion in My Pocket, My Life with Vegetables. I want to talk about some of the meals that you describe as life-changing. And I want to go back to your childhood when your dad mistakenly gave you a cup full of butter.
Oh, yes, he was a little distracted. I think my brother was being born, if you want to know. So, yes, he was distracted, and he thought it was custard. He gave me a cup of butter from our Jersey cows. And I mention that because I really do think that it made me into a butter eater and a cheese eater and an appreciator of those kinds of foods. But it's funny that you mentioned that. You're the only person who has. Thank you.
As a child who used to eat saltine and butter sandwiches, I just that one just touched a chord with me.
I see. Okay.
Tell me, do you remember your first time eating in a restaurant?
I think I do because it was such a rare, rare thing for us. We went to a Mexican restaurant in San Francisco that my father knew of. And it was wonderful. I mean, that was the first time I had been exposed to all the accoutrements of Mexican food, including the saltillo tiles and the paper flowers and the mariachi band. And, you know, it was probably pretty corny, you know, when I think about it now. And I've had so much Mexican food, both here and in Mexico. But at the time, it was marvelous. It was absolutely wonderful.
And tell us about your first, now I hope I say this right, sashin meal?
Sashin meal.
Mm-hmm. With rice and pickles. And before that, you got to tell us what sashin is.
I will.
Okay.
It's a a very intense week-long period of meditation, and it's hard. It's hard to get through. And this was my first one. I had just come back from Japan, and I wasn't really sure I could do it or I should do it, but I knew I would, so I went. And it was actually easier than a lot of sessions I had sat since, but it was my first, so it was very difficult. And I loved the meals because we got to get up and stretch our legs, which felt great. And they were so, so simple. We had a breakfast that consisted of a big bowl of white rice with a few sesame seeds on it, a miso soup, and the same pickles I'd been eating in Japan the week before. And it just was a revelation to me because partly at that time I'd been trying to deal with some sort of anxiety by getting a lot of sweet and soft tastes and flavors in my mouth. And this food was not that. It was very, very, very simple by any standards. And it was delicious. And it taught me so much. You know, it taught me that food didn't have to be complex and fancy in order to be good. I loved it.
Now, I want to talk about vegetarianism here as we conclude. Where do you personally fall on a scale from vegetarian to carnivore, if there is such a scale? How much meat do you eat?
Well, I will eat meat. I do eat meat. I don't have to eat meat. I feel like I'm a natural sort of vegetarian in that I gravitate very much towards that food, but my husband is not, and I cook for him as well. So I eat whatever we make. I have some of it.
And in the larger world, I mean, how do you think the label vegetarian is viewed?
I think it's, as a chef, I think it's hard. It's hard because you're not taken very seriously as either a cook or as an eater, you know, as if you know nothing about food. And if you are really interested in food, then it makes it very, very difficult to claim that you are because people don't think you are. It's that simple. It's kind of it's just a way. And a lot of chefs I know, and I know a lot of chefs, are uncomfortable actually with reaching out to a vegetarian with an interesting menu choice because it's out of their comfort range. They don't understand it. So I sympathize with them when they're pressured to cook a vegetarian meal. It just isn't going to happen necessarily.
And you've written that you've just flat out dislike labels of any kind. And can you tell me kind of why, beyond just in the food world?
Well, the food labels that we're talking about, like vegan and vegetarian and fruitarian and keto and all of that, or non-gluten is one of my pet peeves. I think that they're very, very enticing and very easy to fall into because of their promises. You know, they promise that you're going to feel better, that you're going to feel great, that you might actually become a wonderful person, or, you know. But, in fact, the promises don't really deliver that well. We get old, we age, we get sick, you know, and we don't necessarily follow through because they don't help us in those moments. So, you know, and the worst thing about them is it makes it really hard just to sit down to a meal and say thank you to the host for whatever they've served. And I think that's really important. It matters to me anyway. So that's why I ended the last part of the book on nourishment and a description of meals that were important to me in that I do remember them from a long time ago often, but not because they were free of meat or anything. It was incidental. It was the kindness that they were offered.
If anyone is listening and they've wanted to eat more vegetables, but maybe been feeling, you know, somewhat daunted by the task of all the chopping or the unfamiliarity with what's out there, what piece of advice would you give them?
Well, I would advise them to first of all, get a cookbook. You know, I mean, I think I tried to demystify vegetables and vegetarian cooking for everyone. They're not that difficult to deal with, even for a beginner. And I always advise people to start cooking what you really, really like, what you love to eat. And then if it's a gratin, make a lot of gratins with lots of different vegetables and ingredients. And then you'll get the hang of it. You really, really will. I do think that a kind of disservice has been done to vegetable cooking, partly by new people who are writing books that have very outrageous kinds of vegetable recipes in them. And I think we'd be better off, if we're just getting to know vegetables, to deal with them in very simple ways. Jerusalem artichokes make a great soup. You know, they don't need to be done with grapes and pistachio nuts and honey and this and that and the other thing, which might be perfectly good, but it's beyond our reach. We don't need to do that.
Deborah Madison is the award-winning author of 14 cookbooks, including The New Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone and Vegetable Literacy. In 2016, she was inducted into the James Beard Foundation Cookbook Hall of Fame. Her new memoir is An Onion in My Pocket, My Life with Vegetables. Thank you so much for sharing your stories with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Some people eat vegetables for their health. Others do it because they just don't want to eat animals. When Constant Wonder returns after a short break, we'll look at the surprising history of animal rights in America and the founding of the SPCA. Stay with us. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Henry Berg was a sort of superhero, running through the streets, interrupting traffic, making arrests, all to save a mistreated horse or dog. This Gilded Age activist kick-started the animal rights movement in America. Marcus Smith spoke with Ernest Freeberg, a professor of humanities at the University of Tennessee and author of A Traitor to His Species, Henry Berg and the Birth of the Animal Rights Movement. The funny thing about Berg, we learned, that he wasn't really even much of an animal lover.
I mean, he's clearly sympathized with animals, but he didn't love animals in the sense of, you know, he didn't own pets, had no desire to do that. You know, that wasn't his motivation at all. He wasn't an animal lover, although people considered that he was, you know, almost off the deep end in terms of his love of animals. What he really did was he was motivated by a hatred of human cruelty. He just felt that that was, you know, unacceptable and that, in fact, far from being an inevitable feature of society that some people are cruel and that suffering of animals is a necessary thing, he felt that had to stop, could stop, and was willing to devote his life to making that happen.
So this is kind of a moral crusade to correct what's wrong with us humans.
Yeah, certainly. And I think, you know, one of the thing that's, you know, you mentioned that he actually went out to enforce this. And I think, you know, people who have looked at this suggest that was the real big innovation. There had been laws against cruelty to animals up until this point, until before Berg passed his law in 1866, but they didn't have any real teeth to them. You could not damage somebody else's animal because it was somebody else's property. You know, you couldn't kick somebody else's dog or hit somebody else's horse, not because they had inherent rights, but because they belonged to somebody else. You know, a creature that didn't belong to anybody didn't have any sort of rights under that kind of law. You know, he not only had this law, but he also got the state legislature to empower the ASPCA to appoint its own badge-wearing deputies who went out into the streets and were able to enforce the law. And partly the assumption here was that, you know, the normal policeman's got too many other things on their mind, too many other, you know, and they don't quite know cruelty when they see it. You know, you're allowed to whip your horse, but at what point does whipping it become excessive and unnecessary and cruel, right? You're allowed to slaughter your livestock for meat, but you're not allowed to do that in a way that causes unnecessary suffering while you're doing it. This is a very new idea, and it was these agents, Henry Berg himself, you know, out there arresting people and dragging them to court, but also these agents who were out there either warning people or if they didn't cooperate, actually either arresting them themselves or getting the police to help them and bringing them to court.
So he actually did take cases to court and the plaintiffs were the victims, the animals themselves? Did it go that far?
He did bring a turtle to court once. That was the case that really got him started on this, I think, was that he was, one of the very first cases he took on was to arrest a ship captain who was shipping turtles, green turtles, up from the Key West up into the Fulton Fish Market in New York. And in order to transport them, the standard practice was to flip these animals on their backs, to deprive them of food and water along the trip, along the way, for which could take weeks. And also to pierce their flippers with a rope in order to sort of essentially tie them all together into one big bundle. Berg felt this was outrageous and arrested the ship captain and brought him to court. And he didn't win the case, partly because the defense said, well, a turtle is not an animal. Yes, there's a law against cruelty to animals, but a turtle isn't an animal. It's a fish or it's a crab, and there was this ridiculous, debate about this, with Berg in court saying, look, it's animal, vegetable, or mineral. This is an animal, and therefore it's entitled to protection under the law. So, yeah, at one point in one of these battles over the turtles, they had to actually bring the turtles in and use them as evidence.
So is this the kind of thing where it was so sensational and off the beaten path that this made headlines in the papers? Were people reading about this?
Oh, yes. I mean, he was one of the most famous men in New York in his day for this reason, this cause. And, the New York was, as it is now, one of the centers of media for the rest of the nation. So these Henry Berg stories ended up reprinted all over the country. Here's the latest thing Henry Berg is doing. And you could read it in a little small town paper anywhere across the country. If there was a local person in a town somewhere who was sticking up for animals, trying to stop somebody beating their horse, they'd say, oh, here's the Henry Berg of, Pittsburgh. And so Berg became quite a celebrity. But he also was leading a movement. I mean, he would have gone nowhere if it wasn't for the fact that he also managed to get the attention and support of thousands of men and women. There were SPCAs not just in New York, but very soon after that, there was an SPCA in Boston and there was one in Philadelphia. And within a decade, many, many states across, especially across the North and Midwest and more slowly down into the South, adopted Henry Berg's law, essentially, in one form or another. And that same strategy of founding an SPCA, getting a charter from the state, appointing deputies, and going out into the streets and letting people know that animals had rights.
There was pushback from a lot of people, I'm guessing.
Certainly, right. I mean, and Berg's argument was everybody is against animal cruelty except when it impinges on their own individual privilege, right? So Berg went after people who were staging dog fights and cock fights, the elite who were having pigeon shooting contests, and people who were mistreating their horses by using fancy burrs that would cause pain but make the animal look lively. Just a huge wide range of ways that people were using animals. And they were almost always surprised that Berg would bother their particular, they all said, look, we get the idea that cruelty to animals is a bad thing. We're glad you're doing what you're doing, but you're pushing it too far when you're coming after me, because what I'm doing is what we've always done, or this particular animal doesn't really have feelings, or just mind your own business. So Berg, who was really a very serious fellow, was made the butt of many jokes and cartoons. He had a long, droopy face, long mustaches. He was impeccably dressed in a top hat and silver cane, wandering the streets, arresting Teamsters. And he was reporters just found him to be fascinating. And, every time he was involved in one of these tussles, they would follow him around, and especially because he was very dramatic. People were fascinated by him as a person and why he would bother to do this.
Well, how many different types of animals were under the umbrella of his concern? I mean, I'm just trying to think about, there are people who, the Janes, for example, who will sweep ants aside so they don't step on any living thing. Was he that eccentric in, comparatively speaking, going after protecting almost anything alive?
That's a good and complicated question, and I think he had to wrestle with that. He was not, on the one hand, he would have said, an animal is an animal. All creatures can suffer, and we should never cause unnecessary suffering. On the other hand, what is necessary infliction of pain on the species that we rely on. He was not a vegetarian. He spent a lot of time advocating for improving slaughtering practices. And, you know, there were horrendous practices of shipping livestock from Texas to New York and Boston to wherever, you know, and a lot of suffering of these animals. And he devoted his life to stopping that or not very successfully. But in the end, he was not a vegetarian. You know, he said he cared about turtles, but he also liked turtle soup. So, you know, I think like many people who are trying to be conscientious and live gently in the world, there are a lot of compromises that have to be made, and always the possibility of being accused of hypocrisy. And I think Berg wrestled with that throughout his life.
Well, those were days when rhetoric was at a high pitch. People would say all kinds of – I mean, a traitor to the species, somebody there with that kind of language, they're trying to say – you're fighting for the wrong team altogether, and you're fighting against us. And come, you know, either come back and show your loyalty to humans, or we're going to have to take you on. I mean, those are real strong words.
Sure, they are, and you know, but there again, there were plenty of people who supported what he was doing. Midway through his career, editors would write scathing editorials denouncing his latest attempt to, you know, protect circus elephants or whatever it might be. But they would always preface it by saying, look, we know this is a good cause. We know the basic idea of having a society to look out for the interests of animals is a necessary thing that makes us all more civilized. But this is going too far. You know, this impinges too much on the pleasures and privileges of human beings. So in that sense, he was a traitor.
Do you think that?
But it was situational. It was people finding him to be a traitor when he came along and made their lives inconvenient.
Do you think it was a calculated effort on his part to push the public discourse into a zone where you have to grapple with these definitions and these policies? Because if he's being a little bit over the top, I mean that's a strategy. You know, that's a way to.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if he just had thought that through, or if he just couldn't stop himself because he was zealous and pious, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that's a good point. It's some of both, clearly. I mean, I think with this turtle case that I mentioned, he later on for the rest of his life said, you know, that was a necessary thing because I lost the case, but everybody was talking about me and the movement, you know, and yes, it was notorious. It seemed ridiculous to people, but, you know, the only thing worse than that was people to be apathetic or to ignore me, you know, so I think he was not against taking on and losing as long as it helped to raise consciousness. You know, it's a long-term battle. And I think, you know, he did literally, you know, many people who supported him when he got started, including, you know, I mentioned all the, you know, the mayor and the police chief and the wealthy industrialists, lots of people signed on to support the ASPCA when it was founded. And mostly what they thought they were doing was protecting horses that were in the streets, you know, the trolley horses and so forth that were clearly being overworked and abused sometimes by zealous teamsters. So when Berg started to go after turtles and stray dogs, you know, protecting stray dogs and, you know, even the rats that were being eaten in rat pits where their dogs were chasing them and killing them for contests, all these sorts of things, you know, people said, wait a minute. When we said animals, we meant horses, you know.
Yeah, we got a little bit of mission creep going on there.
Yeah, not for him. I mean, the law basically says, you know, mentions all animals. And so he took that quite literally. People would say, you know, as you're suggesting, well, what about the mosquito? You know, what about the, you know, the pernicious animals? But, you know, again, for, you know, one of the things we struggle with and, you know, the people who have inherited Berg's mission, running animal shelters and dealing with stray dogs and cats, deal with that same question about animal control. I mean, this is the first generation, Berg and others of his allies, dealing with the problem of enormous packs of stray dogs that were roaming city streets. There were, you know, scares about rabies. Period. You know, every summer, mayors would announce a war on dogs and essentially pay a bounty for people to bring in stray dogs for to be killed. And Berg had to grapple with this. On the one hand, to be on the side of stray dogs that seemed to be spreading rabies was going to be bad for the movement, to say the least. But on the other hand, to try to handle this sort of animal control problem in a way that we consider to be enlightened and humane.
Well, we will make good on the P.T. Barnum story in just a moment. I've got a string tied around my finger. But what you're talking about right here really pulls us into the present moment, because if people were maybe wanting to make fun of him and bring up mosquitoes in those days, maybe they were just trying to say, this is ludicrous. This is so far beyond what but even today, I mean, yes, we're worried about mosquitoes as vectors for disease. They certainly don't feel good when they bite you. But we have a kind of culture today where we want to eradicate so many different types of insects. And we're learning now from the eco-scientists that, you know, what are the birds going to eat, right? I mean, those kinds of questions come up.
Yep.
And so these public policy discussions that he was pushing at in his day, I guess they must have sounded incredibly extreme. And yet today, we're still having these conversations.
Yeah, it's true. And it also points, I think, to a juncture in this movement. This was an urban movement, really. You know, the people who joined the SPCAs were city people. This is where those organizations were developed. And partly, I think it was just because that was where the moral center of progress was and the resources to do this sort of thing. It also is the fact that you have a growing number of people on the streets who are observing how other people are treating their animals, you know, in a way that may be less visible in a rural environment. But I think, you know, the suggestion you're bringing up about thinking about animals in terms of the environment, there's really not a lot of that sort of thinking going on in Berg's day. I think the hunting and fishing clubs of the late 19th century, sportsmen are starting to notice the fact that game is disappearing, that birds are being overhunted, you know, that where they used to remember herds of elk, now they're gone. Concern about the destruction, the horrendous destruction of the American bison going on in the 1870s and 80s. But all that's very far from the city, you know. To get back to the turtles, one of the things I thought was really instructive is that Berg worked really hard. If you brought a turtle into New York City and you flipped it upside down and plopped it, you know, alive in front of a saloon with a sign on it that said, "Eat me for soup on Friday," Berg found this horrendous and, you know, was trying to stop those people. But while that was happening, fishermen in the Key West and the Caribbean and all the way down to the Gulf of Nicaragua were destroying turtle populations. That never comes up. That's invisible. That's not seen. You know, you can see the turtle in front of you and develop sympathy for it. It's much harder. You know, I think we're much more used to our ability to think, environmentally. And that was really something that was just starting to develop with the Audubon Society and groups like that, many of them coming out of hunting and fishing. Berg thought hunting and fishing was, you know, like, I guess, like a lot of urban people, found that to be a kind of a strange way to enjoy your time, you know, going out and killing an animal that you didn't have to.
So he's not really an environmentalist per se, and he's not really an animal lover per se. His project really seems to be the reform of the human species so that we'd be more moral creatures.
Yes. And he was pretty pessimistic about that. And he was, you know, he was famously, you know, people would get into conversations with him where he would say, look, people who beat their animals, people who beat their wives and children, they should be flogged. You know, we should strip them to the waist and whip them in the public square. You know, and everybody else was horrified by this, of course, who were reformers and thought he can't possibly mean this. Maybe he didn't mean it, but it sort of gets to his idea that basically there's a part of human nature that's cruel that's only going to be stopped through the power of law.
Yeah.
Many of the other people in that movement did not take that approach. And in fact, another important part of the movement out of this period that I think is still with us is this idea of humane education, especially for children. You know, if you get children to love and care for animals, to think of animals as having a consciousness and they're capable of suffering, you can change the world. I mean, they were very, very optimistic about, you know, I think the most famous piece of literature out of this is Black Beauty, the novel, which I think, you know, I've talked to many people who, you know, still to this day read that book and it made a big impression on them. That was one of the books that came out of this movement that sort of personifies, anthropomorphizes a horse and gets you to start to think about it as a moral being that you would sympathize with. Berg was not against that, But he really felt like the real problem was these, you know, rough men in the streets, and they had to be handled roughly.
Or else they won't be civilized. We've got to
see. You know, they may never get civilized, but if we can just stop them from being cruel, we'll all be better off.
Yeah, yeah. Well, P.T. Barnum, finally, you mentioned elephants earlier. Did they see themselves as standing in firm opposition to each other? They knew each other.
They did. They had a fascinating rivalry. You know, both of them were great promoters. Both of them spent their lives involved with animals. Barnum always claimed that he was doing the public a great service by he gathered these amazing collections, unprecedented in America, collections of animals from around the world, and brought them to his fire trap museums in downtown New York. He had whales in his basement, and he had a giraffe that where he had to cut a hole in the second floor so that the giraffe's neck could stick up.
Wow.
Tigers and snakes and so forth. And inevitably, some of these were treated in ways that Berg found to be distasteful. And Berg was often pushing against Barnum. Barnum loved it because, first of all, he sympathized with Berg. He always said, look, I know a lot more, you know, about animals than you do, and you don't know what you're talking about. But secondly, anytime Berg went after him, Barnum was just a master at turning that into a great piece of publicity. So he would love to have a fight with Berg. And the two of them kind of developed a friendly rivalry. In fact, when Berg died, after, you know, 20 years of them going back and forth and battling over, you know, the treatment of an elephant or the way the zoo was done, or the, you know, Barnum's museum would burn down periodically and Berg would denounce him for even having these kind of museums. But in the end, Barnum attended Berg's funeral. And when he died, he set aside in his will enough money to build a little fountain memorial to Henry Berg in Barnum's hometown of Bridgeport, Connecticut. So they really were partners in many ways in thinking about animals in this time period.
Cornelius Vanderbilt, he was one of the targets of Henry Berg. And, you know, to take on one of the most powerful and wealthiest men alive in that day, that took some whatever, you know.
It did. One of Berg's biggest, first famous targets was the dogfighters. And this was a rough, tumble, urban Irish immigrant crowd in New York City that would gather for these bloody betting matches, dogs pitted against each other. And Berg went in and broke them up and tried to drive them out and denounce them. And people tended to say to him, you're just going after poor people. You know, and he always insisted that while he was a member of the elite class, that it wasn't just poor people who were cruel to their animals, that wealthy people were too. And the case in point that was most important to him was the mistreatment of the horse railroad the trolleys. And these were, you know, these were profoundly important for the Gilded Age city. Up until these horse railroads were brought into the cities, you know, these are essentially what we think of as trolleys that are being pulled by horses along rails, so you could carry a lot more people in them. If it wasn't for those horse railroads, the city would have to stay small, you know, much smaller. You know, the city before the horse railroad was about as big as you could comfortably walk. But once you brought in this new technology where you could travel 6 miles an hour, people could have suburbs. You know, the city began to grow in, you know, become the modern city that we know of. And obviously it's expanded with every innovation of transportation, but the horse railroad was right there at the start. But it was all done on the backs of these poor horses. And there were no laws about how many people could get onto these trolleys, in spite of Berg pushing for this. You know, that so these poor horses would be hauling in a railroad that was a car that was supposed to carry 30 people, there'd be 75. Some of them on the roof, you know, and the horses, as a result, would burn out very, very quickly. You know, a horse would be driven to the point breaking point within a few years, and essentially be recycled, be killed, and sent to the rendering plant, and recycled. You know, there's no going out to pasture when you're done. You know, these were pieces of the industrial machinery, and Vanderbilt was one of the most successful owners of these horse railroads, and Berg targeted him and went after the horse railroads. The courts protected Vanderbilt and said, look, it's not Vanderbilt's fault. It's these poor guys who were hired to run these railroad cars. You can arrest them, but you can't touch Vanderbilt, even though he's the one who's sending them out to do this job. So Berg would stop these railroad cars in the middle of the street. And, you know, here's another example of a traitor to his species. It might be a snowstorm. You know, everybody's in a commute trying to get home. And Berg would say, look, you know, this is, you're mistreating your horse. You can go no further. I'm going to arrest the driver. And there would be these huge traffic jams, you know, 50 trolley cars. Imagine stopping the subway system in a modern city now, and all the commuters who back up only because somebody is looking out for the well-being of one of the horses. Again, Berg took a lot of heat for this, but he was not afraid to take on Vanderbilt and the other horse railroad people, and basically saying, look, you know, you're putting your profit over your basic obligation to creation.
There's something remarkable in here, and this might be what I think is one of the most remarkable of all the stories that you tell about, is the horse ambulances. I'd never heard of any such thing.
Yeah, there are a lot of innovations coming out of this, and the horse ambulance is one, right? And Berg develops this. Horses were constantly slipping on the pavement, breaking their legs, or falling into a cellar hole during the construction projects and that sort of thing, or getting sick. So Berg developed this ambulance, and it apparently was a working ambulance system for horses before there was ever a human ambulance system in American cities. This sort of became a prototype for what became the human ambulance system. They also built watering troughs, and they pushed for better pavements and you know, other ways to sort of protect these animals that were really providing the motive power for these cities. You know, the cities are expanding enormously. You know, the beginnings, the structure of the modern city that we live in is being built in these years after the Civil War. And it's all being done with the power of horseback. So Berg was looking out for them.
Ernest Freeberg is a professor of humanities at the University of Tennessee and author of A Traitor to His Species, Henry Berg and the Birth of the Animal Rights Movement. He was speaking there with Marcus Smith. I'm Tenery Taylor. Constant Wonder will be right back after the news, and we'll investigate a New York City skirmish called the Kosher Meat War of 1902. Then we'll take a quick look at the time the mafia tried to control the New York City bagel industry. Stay with us for more Constant Wonder.